This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to attorney Jarrett Adams, who served 10 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit and now works as a lawyer trying to overturn wrongful convictions. He'll share his story and how to change what he sees as a broken criminal justice system. Now, the director of the Monmouth University poll did something unusual recently. He wrote an op-ed in the Star-Ledger in New Jersey and apologized to Democratic Governor Phil Murphy, his Republican challenger Jack Chittorelli, and the voters of that state. The final poll before the election 2 weeks ago was way off. It had Murphy up by 11 points. That night, it looked like he might actually lose. He wound up winning by 2. In response, pollster Patrick Murray wrote, "I blew it," and that, quote, "inaccurate public polling can have an impact on fundraising and voter mobilization efforts." He also raised a question that, since so many polls have been wrong in recent years, is horse race polling for elections still worth doing? Our next guest says if public opinion data is no longer reliable, American democracy could be in trouble. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about election polls? Do you pay attention to them or do you ignore them? How much confidence do you have in political polling today? Have you been polled? What was it like? Did you give honest responses? Did you hang up the phone? What do you think would be a better way of measuring how people feel about a particular race? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. David Graham is a staff writer at The Atlantic. He wrote a piece after last November's elections saying that the polling crisis is a potential catastrophe for U.S. democracy. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
You saw this piece by pollster Patrick Murray, a pretty influential poll, Monmouth University. What was your reaction to what he had to say?
Well, it was really interesting. And I think it is something to take seriously because Murray is a really well-respected pollster and his polls tend to be very good. And you know, his takeaway that maybe these sort of horse race polling, especially at the end of election, is a bad thing, is really interesting. And that's the kind of thing you don't see pollsters saying a lot. But I think he's onto something. I mean, it's clearly true that we have an unhealthy relationship with polls in this country, and especially between the press and polls in this country. And I think, you know, the backlash after these elections is another example of that.
What do you see as the point of having horse race polls, even if they were good? If we had good, reliable horse race polls that did a pretty good job of predicting the outcome of an election, would that be worth doing?
Well, I think everybody just wants to know. I mean, whether it's almost a question of like whether it's worth doing is a little bit beyond the point because people clearly want to know. We see this in the popularity of polls. We see it in the popularity of places like 538 and, you know, the New York Times Upshot. Like, people just want to know who's up and who's down. And that is both readers and that's the press. So you can see why there's a demand for it. And, you know, I like to know that, too. It's useful to know who might be winning. I think that's important for the press and understanding sort of who to cover and how to cover them. But I also think that can get out of whack to the point where instead of covering the candidates with the polls as a sort of important input and something to illuminate the way we do that, it becomes what we cover. It is the sole focus.
Right. And that could lead to how does this policy affect the candidate in the polling? Is that where you see the coverage getting unhealthy?
Yeah, or like even not to that point. I mean, that's a sort of a level of complication beyond some of what we get, which is what do the polls say? And I've said this before, but I find it really striking. When Nate Silver created 538 during the 2008 election cycle, he thought that it would allow reporters to stop covering polls poorly, which he rightly said a lot of people were doing, and instead to cover policy issues more. And instead now what you see is a lot of us just write about whatever 538 happens to be saying from day to day and week to week.
Apart from how we use the polls, there's also concern about polls being off, and it's happened in a handful of elections, very high-profile elections lately. Do you have thoughts on why they're missing the mark?
It's a really good question, and it's a question that the polling industry is grappling with. You know, we had this big miss in 2016, and afterwards pollsters went back and looked at their numbers and concluded the error had been that they were not sufficiently waiting for education, which means basically they thought that there were going to be, that the electorate was going to be more educated than it did. There were more white non-college educated voters than they believed there would be. And so they were going to fix that in the 2020 election. And they did, many of them. They started paying attention to that. And yet they still missed by several points in a lot of these races. And so there have been similar postmortems after the 2020 election, and they don't really have an answer. I mean, one answer is people, not the right people are answering their phones. The people who are answering their phones seem to be more liberal and more educated, which makes it harder to get a representative sample. But overall, they don't know why, and they don't have a consensus answer about how to fix it either.
Talking to David Graham from The Atlantic about a crisis in political polling, especially those election polls. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, maybe your experience if you have been polled, 800-642-1234. Well, I'll answer a phone now. Let's hear from Jake in Appleton. Jake, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What did you want to bring up, Jake?
You know, I just wanted to share that I'm 28 and I've had the opportunity to vote in three different presidential elections. And every time I've been called for polling, it's always been before debates. And the last two out of the three elections, I've actually changed my decision based on the feedback from the results of those debates. So I think if you poll too early, it leaves a lot on the table for those who are still on the border, or there's issues that are more, you know, important to one for another reason or another. So that's just my feedback on it.
Sure. And Jake, I wanted to ask, when you get these polls, are they just kind of quick hits who you're voting for, or do they dig deep to try to find out more about you?
Very, very light on the demographic information. Essentially just a red or blue voter. No information on gender or any other type of information that they could better track demographic-related patterns. So it's surprising there too, if you're going to take the time to call me, at least get to know me, right?
Interesting, Jake. Well, I'm glad we got to know you a little bit here. David, what do you think about Jake's experience being polled?
Well, one, I mean, it's remarkable to be polled that many times. And I think that maybe is a little bit of a factor of living in an important swing state. Something you hear from a lot of people is, well, I've never been polled, so the polls can't be genuine. Although statistically, the odds of actually getting polled are remarkably low. I think his point about the debates is really interesting. One of the polls that, one of the kinds of polling we see, there are different kinds of polls, but sometimes you'll try to poll a representative sample and a pollster will choose a different representative sample every time around. Other ones will stick with the same group of people, and then you can sort of track how they're changing their views over the course of an election season. Those polls have had a pretty good performance the last couple cycles. So maybe there's something to what he's saying. I'd also say, like, one thing he's pointing to there is, and your question is, the difference in quality in pollsters. Some of these pollsters are simply a lot better than others. They're more careful. They're doing more work. They're getting larger samples. And so it's important to look at who the pollsters are. But even some of the high quality ones have had some notable misses recently.
Jake, thanks for that call. We're talking about election polls and whether they're useful or useless or some point in between. David Graham is with us from The Atlantic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about polling today? When it is election season, do you watch polls? Compulsively, maybe, whether you want to or not. Can't stop refreshing 538, or do you ignore them? Do you think they're harmful in some way? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about political polling in an op-ed piece in the New Jersey Star-Ledger. The director of the Monmouth University poll says he blew the governor's race in that state, and maybe it's time to get rid of election polls. Our guest says America's polling crisis is a big deal. We can't count on polls to accurately measure how people think. David Graham is with us from The Atlantic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you follow polls? Do you think they're a waste of time? Have you been polled yourself? What was it like? 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go back to your calls now. Paul is with us in Northern Illinois. Paul, hi.
Hey, how you doing? I always love your show.
Thanks.
Love the way you work it, and it oozes of intellectualism.
Is that good? I can't tell. Go ahead, Paul.
That knowledge is power. It's, you know, having a view of what is things as they develop is a really good thing. I think when we talk about that, we have different sources, some of them reliable, some of them not reliable. We start to fall into, I think, a trap with the tribalist politics that we've been playing, especially of late. And we start thinking more team than we do sort of the outcome and governance in general. So I find it to be a very negative thing to sort of overdo it like we do so many other things. And I guess that's all I had to say.
Paul, thanks. Interesting point. David, polling might just be reinforcing our tribal divisions, as Paul says it. And maybe when we answer a poll, we're just telling you what team we're on.
I think that's exactly right. There's a real feedback loop there. A lot of questions, if you look at them, they look like sort of how do you feel? Really, you know, whatever the answer that's being asked, the answer looks a lot like how do you feel about Donald Trump? You know, that's questions of, you know, whether you thought the election was fair and so on and so forth. You can look down the line. And it's not clear that we're really measuring people's true views about what they feel, but they know what the quote unquote right response for their team is. And then once those numbers get in polls, people see those polls and they are reinforcing what they think the quote unquote right answer for their team is. So I think there's a real feedback loop there that does kind of feed into tribalism.
Thanks for that call, Paul, at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Sarah with us in Madison. Sarah, hi.
Hello. You caught me eating just a
second. Early lunch or just a snack?
No, just a snack. Okay. That I shouldn't have been eating anyway. So anyway, I just wonder how, I don't know how much they gave you the information. I'm just wondering how much pollsters are being affected by people like our family and friends who are so sick of all the fraudulent calls we get and scam calls that we really don't answer our phones anymore unless we recognize the number.
Oh, Sarah, thank you so much for sharing that. And David, Sarah and her friends and family are not alone. A lot of people won't pick up a phone, period, and certainly not from an unrecognized number like a pollster might have.
That's exactly right. And now, there's also a generational effect where, you know, a lot of younger voters simply don't have landlines, and it's harder to dial cell phones and to get a hold of cell phones. So this is a real problem for pollsters. They have tried various ways to get around this. One thing is they just try to reweight. So if they get too small a sample of a certain demographic compared to what they expect in the electorate, they will sort of double that in the weight. The other thing they've done is they're experimenting with different ways of polling, like using the internet. And for a long time, internet polling was looked down on as inaccurate. The last few years, as methods have gotten better, some pollsters have had pretty good results using internet polling. But the gold standard remains getting people on the phone, and that's harder to do these days.
Sarah, thanks for calling at 800-642-1234. Talking to David Graham from The Atlantic about a crisis in political polling. Want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Just a few minutes. Going to have an open call in. You can share your thoughts. How do you use polls? Do you ignore them completely? Do you think they're a problem? 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. David, I want to ask about another kind of polling. We've been focusing on the horse race. Are you going to vote for candidate A or B or C or D if they're out there? How about issue polling? Some people have said this is better because you're not trying to predict turnout, who's actually going to vote in the election. It can give a snapshot of what people think about abortion, gun control, marijuana legalization, whatever.
Yeah, I think issue polling is an important tool, especially in the sort of fragmented nation we have now. You know, people are, the general unit is no longer the sort of town meeting. We are increasingly sorted into neighborhoods and cities based on people we agree with. And so we don't get a sort of a wide range of opinion. Our representatives in Congress have larger and larger constituencies compared to what they were historically. So it's just a lot harder to know what people think without those issue polls. And that's why I think polling, despite its flaws, can't really be thrown out. Now, you know, issue polling has its flaws. It seems like in a lot of cases you get answers that suggest, on polling, suggest a much more liberal population than what we actually have. But as Patrick Murray pointed out of Monmouth in that piece, you know, they're a little less fraught because you're not trying to predict who is going to turn out to vote. What you're trying to do is simply measure how the population feels, and that's an easier task. You know, less prone to mistakes about guesses.
I'm thinking back to those '80s commercials on TV, where there's got to be a better way to do whatever it was. Is there a better way, do you think, to have good constructive conversations in American politics that really give us insight to what people are thinking?
I think it's really hard, especially in a big country. I mean, you can do a lot of these things on a smaller level. But I think the old way was flawed for a lot of reasons. You know, what you had was a few editors and at major TV stations and newspapers making guesses about what they believe people thought, and then making their coverage decisions from them, and then feeding that to the population. And that is really, you know, you can really get a warped idea. People who are sitting at a desk somewhere may not actually know what people are thinking out, you know, many miles and many states away. And so having something that is actually data, I think, is really important. We just need to be more conscious, I think, about when we're giving too much weight to that data. And we also need to recognize that while it is data, it is not cold, hard science. There's human flaws in there and human assumptions. And we need to take that into account when we're interpreting them and making judgments based on them.
And in just our last half minute, before we throw things to our callers at 800-642-1234, David, you follow politics closely. Even with your doubts on polls, do you think you're going to be following them, say, in next year's election season?
Oh, you know it. I mean, I'm like the rat with the sugar water. I know it's bad for me, but I cannot resist it. It's just so alluring. And so I understand the impulse very well.
David, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's David Graham, staff writer at The Atlantic. We talked with him about problems with election polling, why he says there's no longer a really reliable way of gauging how Americans feel about the horse race, if you want to think about it that way, leading up to an election. Now you can weigh in on that topic at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. A straw poll on what you think of political polling. Have you lost faith in election polls? Did you ever have any to begin with? Like them or not, do you follow them more and more as election day approaches? Do you think there's a better way? Do you want to see less coverage of polls in the media? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Marcus joins us now in Madison. Marcus, hi.
Good afternoon. Mr. Graham, the interesting discussion, but the article that you're citing, as I take it, wants to do away with polling that has to do with predicting at the accuracy of numbers in advance, elections, so on. But what I've always found interesting watching polls over many, many years is that while polling is terrible at that, it's often very good at polling like or dislike. People aren't usually going to misrepresent that. So what I've noticed, regardless of administration, for instance, when you're talking about presidents, is that often at different periods, the president is very well liked as a person, their personality, but I find that in very high numbers, their policies are almost universally hated. So the policies are hated, but the people may be liked, which demonstrates to me that the public has almost zero influence on policy making.
Interesting. Marcus, thanks a lot for starting us off at 800-642-1234, taking your thoughts on election polling, polling in general. Mark joins us next in Bloomer. Mark, hi.
Hi there. So every so often I get one of these people calling me to take the poll, and I struggle because, frankly, I've never liked either candidate that's running, Republican or Democrat, and so I'm stuck. Because I can't honestly vote for either people. I'm voting for the one who I want to defeat the guy I like less.
So, Mark, you have trouble answering the poll. Come election day, if I may ask, do you find yourself choosing a candidate, or are you still stuck then?
I picked the candidate who is the least offensive.
Okay.
They both offend me, but the least offensive is the one I picked.
Mark, thanks a lot for sharing. That'd be interesting if polls could. I mean, pollsters do try to measure that level of excitement or engagement with candidates. Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We heard on Facebook from Luke, who says there are a lot of people out there who purposefully mess with polls given the opportunity to do so. That's their prerogative, but if you're going to do that, then stop complaining about polls being wrong. I know that's a concern among pollsters as well. Still time for you to share your thoughts on polling. If you follow them or not, or think they're bad in some way, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We heard from Zachary on Facebook, who says he feels like answering questions on a poll becomes clear they're steering you to the outcome they see as favorable. Interesting. I know there are push-pulls out there. Back to your calls now. Sarah is with us in Libertyville, Illinois. Sarah, hi.
Hello. Hi. I was listening interestedly to this, and I was started to think about how campaigns all do their internal polling, and then they make their decisions, a lot of them based on their internal polling. And I'm wondering, and I haven't heard, like, if that's getting more unreliable, or is it? And are they doing less of it, or do they do it differently somehow that they think is more useful?
And Sarah, have you been polled ever yourself?
You know, I got one phone call once, and I just got irritated and a half.
Oh, no. Okay, so you didn't end up being counted in that one. I got you. Sarah, interesting. Thanks a lot for sharing that. I know I've talked to Charles Franklin from the Marquette poll about those internal polls for campaigns as well. But he says they're kind of guarded. We don't always know what is happening inside those polls and how well they do. Well, you can keep telling us how you feel about polls and surveys. You can do that in a couple different ways. You can email ideas@WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Got an open conversation there. And we just heard from Ed, actually, on Facebook, who says, it's also time to end the process of suggesting the Democratic Party has also already lost the midterm election that will take place next year. There's a water that will go over the dam before the election takes place. Interesting point. The polling of today may not reflect the elections of a year from now. Again, keep sharing your thoughts on polling on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Thanks to everybody who weighed in on political polling. Thanks for standing up and being counted. And again, if you didn't get on, you got something to say, leave a comment on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, electric vehicles are on the rise, more and more models coming out, more of them on the road. But are everyday drivers ready for them? And how about our infrastructure? Do we have the charging stations and other infrastructure needed to meet the needs of that new electric fleet? Check out the EV Future and share your thoughts, questions, and experiences. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Remember, you can follow all these conversations all the time. Head over to WPR.org, stream the Ideas Network and the NPR News and Classical Music Network live, and consult our archives while you're there, and take us with you wherever you go. Not just on a radio, you can download the Wisconsin Public Radio to your tablet or smartphone. We'll be with you wherever you go. And, of course, share your thoughts on The Morning Show, Larry Miller Show, and here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Jarrett Adams spent nearly a decade in prison here in Wisconsin after a wrongful conviction for sexual assault. After getting his conviction overturned, his record expunged, he became an attorney himself, working with others who are wrongfully behind bars and with people who have long sentences for minor offenses. He shares his story in his new book, a firsthand account of some of the injustices in our criminal justice and prison systems, and how he's trying to make them right. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or someone you know spent time in the criminal justice system? How did it impact life after getting out? What barriers to reentry did you encounter? Do you have questions for our guest about his experience and the justice system here in Wisconsin, which has the worst racial disparity for imprisonment in the entire country? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jarrett Adams is an attorney and the author of the new book, Redeeming Justice, From Defendant to Defender, My Fight for Equity on Both Sides of a Broken System. Jarrett, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thank you for having me. I appreciate being back on.
Well, you've shared your story with us in the past. I want to focus in on a particular moment here. You write in your introduction, quoting, "In this country, we have two criminal justice systems, the one you can afford and the one you can't." Can you talk about how that system let you down? It worked differently for you and one of your then friends who was charged, was able to afford an attorney. Can you talk about that double system?
Yeah, it's a double system for sure. I mean, and you don't have to just take my words for it. You can look at the numbers and they glaringly show it. In my case in particular, there were three of us accused of the sexual assault. Only one of my friends was able to afford an attorney. Me and my other co-defendant, you know, we were assigned an attorney off of a panel list. And that directly impacted my case so much so that the retained attorney for my friend was filing motion after motion after motion. my attorney and my other co-defendant's panelist attorney as well never joined in this motion. They never gave us the opportunity to. They made the decision to proceed forward to trial, and it was the fork in the road that took almost a decade of both of our lives.
And that's one of the most frustrating parts of your story, to read the interactions you had with lawyers during your trial. Can you talk about how that system let you down? And you write, it's not just that it's the lawyers themselves. Those public defenders are often overwhelmed with many cases.
They definitely are. And in particular, in my case, we didn't get public defenders. You know, the public defender's office was conflicted out. So we were assigned attorneys off of a panel list in the state of Wisconsin, and in other states as well. There's a panel list of attorneys who are assigned cases by the court. And the problem with that is this. First of all, the amount of pay is so low that you don't get the best representation. Not many attorneys are going to go do cases for $50 an hour or $70 an hour. And so that was, you know, a big issue in my case as well. And then, you know, it's one of these things, Rob, where you're on an island and you are facing the might of the entire system. They're not playing when they say state versus whoever it is. And it was just glaring. No investigator was hired in my case. And I thought it was just me. When I got to prison and when I started to meet other men and helping them with their cases and learn about their cases, I saw this across the board.
You spent time almost 10 years in Wisconsin's prison system. And you write that for people there wrongly or who were guilty, you don't see the prison system doing a lot of good to turn them around. What were some of the biggest flaws, the problems you saw in Wisconsin prisons?
You know, it's just, first of all, there's overcrowding. It's way too many people who are in prison, and they are in prison as a result of these old draconian sentences and in the ways in which we feel like lock them up, throw away the key forever. And so, you know, you're in this prison, and these mandatory sentences, they are the seed for hopelessness. If people know that they're going to be in prison, no matter how good they are, no matter how much they change and how much they reform, if they know they're going to be in prison for two decades, there's no incentive for them to do anything positive at all. So that was one of the biggest things. Another thing is this, Rob, there's no correcting at all going on. You're being warehoused in this prison, and you're pretty much just getting up, going to sleep, getting up, going to sleep. There has to be an investment in the people that are there. Inmates are people as well. And you just don't see the educational tools being handed out. Most people who are incarcerated will go home at some point. And we are doing a horrible job of preparing people to reintegrate back into society.
Talking to Jarrett Adams, attorney, author of the new book, Redeeming Justice, From Defendant to Defender, My Fight for Equity on Both Sides of a Broken System. You can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. Jarrett, something I hadn't known until I read your book, you ended up in Bosco Bell, once called the Supermax prison in Wisconsin, billed as being this site for the worst of the worst in the prison system. How did you end up there?
So you know that old saying in baseball, if you build it, they will come? That's exactly what Boscoville was. There was this rush to build this sparkling brand new facility for the worst of the worst. And it was one of these things where they took the Jeffrey Dahmer murder and they used that to scare people into getting the funding to build this prison. And when they built it, there was no worst of the worst like that. There was only a handful of people who you could say even, you know, deserved and met the criteria to be there. So what they did was this. They started to, like almost like a quota ticket system, they started to create allegations of confidential informants and putting people in segregation for 360 days at a time. And they swept me up in one of those. And they did this in large part because I continued to litigate against the Department of Corrections, their handbook, and some of the things that we weren't getting access to education-wise in there. So it's just, it was one of these things where you had this message going out that it was necessary, that it was needed. But then you saw people going there for, they broke off the front of their razor to get a close shave, or, you know, this person had food in his cell. And it just was ridiculous. And I don't think anyone really looked under the hood until, you know, they had so many people packed and the litigation finally opened up Boscoville to a normal prison that it is now.
Okay, Jarrett, you spend almost, again, 10 years. You've been working on your case the whole time. The Innocence Project helps out. Finally, you get the conviction overturned. Your record was expunged. If you had said, I'm going to stay as far away from prisons and the legal system as I possibly can, I would get it. You went the opposite direction. What made you decide to become a lawyer and work to prevent this from happening to other people?
You know, I will. There are certain things that I will never forget, you know, being in prison for so long. And one of the things isn't an act of violence. It was looking at the creases of pain and anguish on my mother's face. You know, I'll never forget seeing that. And I also acknowledge this. Look, this started because I told my parents I was going to spend the night over a friend's house. My friends told their parents they were spending the night over my house. So we snuck to Wisconsin to go to this party. And it just was the worst fears realized. I now know why my mother was creative and keeping me busy in the summer. And, you know, all type of things that African-American parents have to do to keep their kids out of trouble. And so when I came home, I knew I had a penchant for the law, and it became a passion, and I was driven to remove the wrinkles and creases of anguish off of other mothers' faces as well.
You had vowed you wouldn't come back to Wisconsin unless you did it as an attorney. Can you share this moment, you share it in the book, at the state capitol, I think it was, when you were sworn into the Wisconsin bar?
You know, I was sworn into the Wisconsin bar by Keith Finley. So it was
of the Innocence Project.
Yeah, of the Innocence Project. And so it was really, you know, really a dream type moment, you know, to hear him, you know, swear me in, you know, motion that I get in and I be accepted and acknowledged by all of the justices. And I'll make this point too, Rob. If the justices, if the courts could see me as I am now, when I was a 17-year-old, I never would have been sentenced to 28 years in prison. And so I think it's a point that I want to emphasize on, and I enjoyed the moment, and it inspired me to keep going to create other Jarrett Adams.
We're talking to Jarrett Adams, attorney, author of the new book, Redeeming Justice, From Defendant to Defender, My Fight for Equity on Both Sides of a Broken System. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you experienced the criminal justice system on either side as someone accused of a crime, somebody defending that person, somebody prosecuting it? Have you seen somebody in your family go through this experience? Have you yourself? What could we do better, do you think, here in Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions for our guest. It's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Jarrett Adams about his new book, Redeeming Justice, From Defendant to Defender, My Fight for Equity on Both Sides of a Broken System. Now an attorney, he was wrongfully convicted, spent almost 10 years in jail, or in prison, I should say, before the conviction was overturned, his record expunged. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Alicia is with us in Portage. Alicia, hi. Alicia, are you there? Nope. Let's go to Vivian then in Green Bay. Vivian, hello.
Hello. I am a product of a very rural Wisconsin community. I'm in my 70s and watching exposés, going back to the New York Five, to so many things through the Innocence Project, I think justice system is a misnomer. And when anyone refers to it that way, I say we don't have a justice system, we have a judicial system, and I've never had any encounters in that system, but I don't see it as a justice system.
Vivian, thanks a lot for the call. Jarrett, what do you think of Vivian's distinction?
I agree, and it's, you know, it's encouraging, you know, to have, you know, someone in Green Bay in their 70s who's been around a while and seen a lot in life, you know, to acknowledge that. And now we just need the officials, the lawmakers, to acknowledge it as well. We have a system that pounds people, especially people of color. One in every 36 Black Wisconsin adults is incarcerated in a state prison in Wisconsin. I mean, that number should make everyone drop what they're doing and turn their attention to fixing this system.
Thanks for that call, Vivian, at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Pierre in La Crosse. Pierre, hi.
Yeah, I am calling because the justice system, there is a white justice system and there is a Black justice system, which you can't even say call justice system, because I have a family member that was charged with a crime. They charged with the highest crime. In order for them to just try to negotiate it to a lower crime, where they should have charged them that at, in the first place. And in the same person, they were charged high with a felony. And I know another person that did almost the same crime. They got charged with two different felony, but that person with the two different felony ended up having no probation, nothing to do because they were white. And that other family member ended up having to be on probation for a year and paying a whole bunch of fines that he cannot even afford.
Pierre, thanks for the call. Is this a common story, you think, Jarrett? Two different systems, Pierre says, depending on race.
Absolutely. I mean, and I think people should you know, just look at the numbers. You know, look at the recent article that came out. You know, in Wisconsin, 42% of the state prison population in 2019 was African Americans. I mean, just think about that. Think about the number of residents in the population in Milwaukee, which is the biggest jurisdiction where the African-American population is. I mean, if you think about the men that we have incarcerated and you think about the issues that exist within the inner cities, you're taking away a proponent that could fix, that can change, that can mentor. We're literally throwing away people with this truth in sentencing. And it was ran on the basis of, let's do truth in sentencing. Let's, you know, have all of these sentences where we give this time and they have to complete it because it'll make us safer. Rob, it's not safer. It's not.
Pierre, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. And Pierre's call reminds me, Jarrett, he talked about, you know, being charged with one thing and settling for a lesser offense, something you learned from your personal experience. And then again, as an attorney, is a lot of times people, especially maybe a young person in that situation, it's complicated. Courts are complicated things. They may not be getting good advice when they're making that kind of decision on the spot.
Absolutely. And there's also this, Rob. Look, people make decisions sometimes to get out of the pain that they're in. And I met a number of different men who pled guilty just to get out of the Milwaukee House of Corrections, only to come back and go to prison because they were on parole. And I think that, you know, one of the things that we have to inject in our system is this. We have to get more therapists, social workers, forensic psychologists. We need to allow the world of therapy to mend this system. I mean, I'm talking about both ends, right? I'm talking about both correctional officers. I've seen and have befriended some correctional officers who come in to these jobs and within, you know, a year or even months, I mean, it's almost like they're an inmate as well. They're feeling the effects of this system, which is telling us something. The system isn't working.
Talking to Jarrett Adams, attorney. He was wrongfully convicted, spent almost 10 years in Wisconsin prisons. His new book is called Redeeming Justice, From Defendant to Defender, My Fight for Equity on Both Sides of a Broken System. Jarrett, wrongfully convicted. You're in prison for so long, 360 days in segregation, as we mentioned, at Boscobel. What got you through?
You know, I had a round table of angels and my mother and my two aunts, and I opened the book up, Redeeming Justice, the first page is a dedication to them. And what they would do is they would write letters in a staggered approach. One would write a letter on Monday, the other on Wednesday, the other on Friday. And they would write these letters and they would, you know, have Bible verses inside of them. And, you know, I asked my aunt, you know, because she would give me like the newspaper subscription. I would get it late. And I asked her, I said, why do you, you know, send this paper still and you guys write these letters? I hear from you guys enough. I'll talk. And she says, no, listen, there's a reason why we're doing it. And the reason why we're doing it is this. We've acknowledged that they've confined your body, but you can never let them incarcerate your mind. And that was one of the things that kept me getting through. You know, when I came home and I was on a race pace to get this law degree. And I remember my boss at the time, I was working at the Federal Defender, you know, she was just like, you know, look, you got to take a break. Like, what are you, you know, moving so fast for? And the real reality, Rob, was this: that decade wasn't just stolen from me. It was stolen from my family as well. I was cookouts, fish fries before I went to prison. I come home, there's dialysis treatments, there are visits in old folks' homes. So I was racing because I wanted my aunts to see me get this law degree. And I was fortunate enough to get that done before my aunt Josephine passed away.
Let's go back to our callers now. Tina is with us in Shawano. Tina, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you want to tell us about?
Well, I've been a practicing attorney in Wisconsin for almost 34 years now. And I've been a prosecutor a couple times. I've been a defense attorney. I've been a social services attorney. I've been a judge on a few occasions. And, you know, my observation is that our system is not only broken, it's completely corrupt. You know, not only do we treat, you know, people of color, you know, differently, substantially differently, you know, it's really all about money. The courts have to, it's like any other bureaucracy, the courts have to make money. And they charge fines that no one can pay. No one can pay those, even if they have, you know, a decent job, which in Shawano is like $14 an hour. You know, they don't take an effect, you know, how this process affects families. You know, they drag out cases, they overcharge, they over-sentence. I mean, it's completely corrupt. It doesn't work at all. And if we want a system that works, we have to provide more of it. You know, for lack of a better word, in the Native American community, we would call it a healing program.
Tina, thanks a lot for sharing your perspective. And Jarrett, that reminds me, part of your work now is on wrongful convictions. You're also worried about what Tina mentioned there, overcharging people for lesser crimes, either longer prison systems, sentences, or as Tina mentioned, unpayable fines.
Absolutely. I mean, Tina was spot on with that. We over-punish and pummel the poor. In our society, I want people to understand there are people in living in the inner city, you know, in Milwaukee, where every dollar and penny is accounted for month to month. And so, you know, a speeding ticket, a red light camera ticket or something like that can throw them off of their entire budget. You know, I also want to point out this, you know, I'm representing a guy right now, Antoine Robbins. You know, he was convicted of an armed robbery along with his co-defendant, who was Caucasian. His co-defendant, you know, received a significantly less sentence and has been home now for quite some time after only serving about 7 years. Mr. Robinson has been in prison now for the last 20 years on an armed robbery where no one was killed and no one was shot. It makes absolutely no sense why we can't even get a court to you know, consider really using the law of sentence modifications. It's just, we have to overhaul the system, and that overall has to be more than just changing the faucet. We need to rip up the floor and change the pipes.
Jarrett, just in our last minute, do you see that happening anytime soon, that kind of reform, that kind of overhaul?
Well, it's anything like this on this grand scale is going to take a lot of folks, a lot of time and a lot of resources. And this has to be spearheaded by the law schools as well as the judicial system and the lawyers and prosecutors. Everyone has to have an all hands on deck approach. And I'll use this as an example. We just dealt with the pandemic where for a while people stopped fighting with each other because we were fighting this deadly virus. And you know what we did was come together and figure it out. And then we went back to fighting each other. But the point I'm making is if we all came together and decided to make change, real change, systematic change, where we got diverse people on the bench and in a prosecutor's office, we would have a much better system and we would have much better communities than we have right now.
Jarrett, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. You guys have me back anytime.
That's Jarrett Adams, attorney and author of the new book, Redeeming Justice, From Defendant to Defender, My Fight for Equity on Both Sides of a Broken System. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, it's our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. Tomorrow includes the signing of the long-awaited infrastructure bill, plus some new developments in the ongoing January 6th investigation in the U.S. House. And we'll get some advice on staying safe in Wisconsin during deer hunting season for hunters, hikers, and more. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.